And so just while we're changing over, I'll introduce our next speaker, who is going to introduce us to yet another modeling paradigm, or analysis paradigm, perhaps. And this is Dr. Noina Priekop, who is an associate professor here in the School of Computer Science at McGill University, who has considerable experience with a number of different types of machine learning, including some neural network work that she's going to talk about a little bit today.
Hello. Can you hear me? Okay. So it was interesting actually seeing the previous talk because during my usual life, I actually have half a brain which thinks about agents and half a brain which thinks about statistics. And so I find these approaches very different but also complementary. I will start with a disclaimer. I'm a computer scientist, and I have not really thought about obesity much at all until today. However, being here this morning, it was actually very interesting to see this wealth of data that people have. And it's really tantalizing to think about all the analysis that we could actually do using this data. That's not what I'm going to talk about, since I'm just sort of learning about this thing. But I'm going to talk a little bit about a sort of very micro level of analysis, which is the level of individuals, and more specifically, the mechanisms inside an individual's brain that might be related to phenomena like obesity, overeating, and so forth. So I'm going to talk a little bit about dopamine and about its role in obesity. I'm going to talk about reinforcement learning, which is a computational model that explains a lot of the dopamine activity data. And I'm going to talk a little bit about neural nets, which are a computational model that we use in this framework. Dopamine, probably many of you know more about this than I do, but it's a very important neurotransmitter. It's involved in many diseases, Parkinson's disease more prominently. It's also involved in drug addiction. And so as a result, it's been studied extensively since the 60s, and for a long time, people have thought that this is somehow a reward mechanism in the brain that evaluates sort of reward or potential for reward and hence drives behavior. And when I was asked to give this talk, I went and sort of looked around a little bit in the literature on obesity to see if there were any sort of overlapping issues that I could talk about. And I was excited to see that actually people think that dopamine somehow is perhaps related to phenomena that happen in obesity that are related to this topic. There doesn't seem to be a consensus. There's bits and pieces here and there. So, for example, there's some evidence that drugs that regulate dopamine help people lose weight and help people maintain a healthy weight afterwards. There's evidence that people in which the dopamine receptors are malfunctioning are more prone to obesity. But there doesn't seem to be necessarily a coherent picture. However, the exciting thing is that dopamine is actually, from a computational point of view, very well understood. It is perhaps the place where computational neuroscience has made the most impact on real neuroscience. And so I would like to present to you basically a computational model for how dopamine functions, what it might do in the brain, and then this might perhaps drive a discussion of how this might be relevant to the research that's talked about here. Okay? So the paradigm, the computational paradigm that I'm going to talk about is called reinforcement learning. It has roots back in animal learning theory, starting with Skinner. And so on the picture over there, you have a little mouse, which is trying to get food by pressing the correct sequence of levers. And so it's being conditioned using a food reward. And over time, the mouse learns, actually pretty quickly, what the correct sequence is in order to get its reward. Okay? So there's two important issues here. One is trial and error learning. The animal is trying things out and then figuring out what it is that produces reward. And another interesting thing is that the reward might actually be delayed. The mouse doesn't get anything until it performs the entire correct sequence. So this has been used as a model in classical conditioning, instrumental conditioning. I'm going to talk about this in the context of artificial agents. I'm going to sort of explain what the model looks like, and then we'll go back to natural agents. So from a point of view of an artificial agent, what we have is we have an environment. The single agent is embedded in this environment. Think of this as perhaps a little robot or one of the agents that Ross talked about before. At every time step, the agent perceives the state of its environment, and based on that perception, it will take an action. Okay? And as a result of the action, the state of the environment might change, but the agent also receives a reward. And in a computer, we model this using numbers. Okay? So you can sort of roughly think of a positive number as being good and a negative number being bad. And so the goal of this agent is to maximize the total reward that it receives over time. So it's not a short-sighted agent. It doesn't necessarily want to maximize the immediate reward. It wants to look over a longer period of time and maximize its long-term return. Okay, so this is the sort of computational framework. Now, in order to think about the long-term return, it's actually useful sometimes to evaluate what it might be. So I'm going to call the value of a state basically the expectation of reward or of long-term return that we have from that state. And there's different ways to think about it. The one that I'm going to use, I'm sorry, there's some equations in the stock.
The one over here.
So what does this mean? The value of a state is computed as the sum of all the rewards that we're going to get starting from that state onwards. This is conditioned on the way the agent is behaving. And there's a little discount factor in there. Discount factor basically says, I'm much happier to get a dollar today than I am to get a dollar in a year. Okay? Because there's some inflation rate or there's some chance that I might die in the meantime. And so future rewards get discounted. So the general approach that this paradigm takes is that an agent will try things out. It will interact with its environment. It will try to estimate the value of different states. And over time, the states that lead to positive outcomes, unexpected positive outcomes, will be strengthened. So actions that lead into those states will also be strengthened. Okay? So that's the basic idea. Here's a very simple example from an application which happens to be one of the early successes in this field. This is a game of backgammon. Many of you probably have played this at some point in time. So just to give you some intuition on the terminology that I'm using, a state in this game is just the configuration of pieces on the board and the dice roll that the agent got. And the agent can choose to do any legal move. The reward is only received at the end of the game. Okay, so there's a plus one at the end of the game if you win and a minus one if you lose. And there's no rewards along the way. So the reward is really delayed. This is a difficult problem. At the end of the game, you have to retrospect and figure out what it is that you did that was good or that was bad. Okay. Now, what's the value of a position? The value of a position in this case is going to be the probability of winning from this position. Okay. And this is what the agent is going to try to estimate. And when it acts, it will think, what are my possible moves? What's the estimated value of each position I could get to? And it will prefer to take actions which have a high probability of winning from the next state. So the agent is always thinking ahead a little bit, okay, and trying to get to favorable positions. So that's the basic idea. Now, how do we do this computationally? The model that I'm going to focus on is called temporal difference learning. This was introduced by Sutton in 1988. And it uses an estimate here via VST of the value of a state. So via VST is the value perceived by the agent at time step t. At the next time step t plus 1, the agent has gotten another reward, and it now perceives a different value via VST plus 1 based on whatever changed. And so what's going to drive this learning is this interesting error here. Okay, so what does this error signal say? This says I'm going to compare my estimate now to the estimate that I get after I take one action. Okay? So I might have gotten to a state that's better than I expected, in which case this is good news. This action is promising I'm going to strengthen it. Next time I'll be more likely to take it. Or maybe I've gotten to a state that's really a lot worse than I thought it was going to be, in which case the probability of this action next time is going to be decreased. So this temporal difference error is, in some sense, an element of surprise. How surprised am I at the next time step in the outcome that I have seen? And we're going to use this error signal to drive the estimation of the values. And over time, of course, we would like this estimate to go down to zero. If the agent had perfect knowledge of its world and there was no randomness, and everything would be known, then the agent could probably estimate correctly values, and this error would be zero over time. Okay, so this has been used in many different applications. Backgammon happens to be one of the early ones. The little network over here is basically the brain inside the backgammon player that was trained by this type of method. And what it tries to predict is the probability of winning based on the board position and the dice configuration. And then the weights in this network are trained using this error signal. I will talk about the network in more detail a little bit in a minute. It's been used also in controlling helicopters, transportation, logistics, lots and lots of optimization problems. It's a very well-studied domain. The place where perhaps this is most relevant to people here is in explaining the activity of dopamine neurons in the brain. And if I could have the other microphone, that would be better. So I think I have to point to the slide. Okay. All right, so dopamine, despite the fact that it was studied since the 60s, was not really well understood until the 1990s. In the 90s, early 90s, Wolfram Schultz's lab developed techniques for measuring very precisely dopamine activity from single neurons in the brain. And so they started measuring dopamine activity in monkeys, which were being conditioned. They would have to perform a reaching movement, and then after the movement, they would be given a drop of juice. Okay, and that's the reward. And until then, there were different sort of hypotheses about what the dopamine might do. In particular, it was thought to model either rewards or values. Okay, and so the recordings here are from Schultz's lab. Each of these rows down here of dots comes from a distinct monkey. Okay. And in particular, a distinct neuron in this particular monkey performing the task. And this is aligned, time-aligned. At this point here, the juice comes. Okay, so this is before learning. We have no stimulus. The juice comes. Okay, and what you see over here is that all these neurons, after receiving the reward, are happily firing. Okay, so this is consistent with the fact that dopamine is a reward signaling mechanism. However, if you do this as a classical conditioning task where now there's a conditioning stimulus, which happens over here, okay, you look at where the reward comes at this point, and there's absolutely no activity at all. Okay. Instead, all of these neurons are activating a little bit after the conditioning stimulus. Okay. So what is it that they're predicting, really? It can't be reward, because then we should see activity right over here, okay? And so their hypothesis, which they have shown through this computational model, is that dopamine is actually showing you the prediction error or the temporal difference error. So over here, we have learned that we will receive a reward. There's no prediction error. Dopamine does not get activated. But here, we haven't yet learned that this conditioning stimulus necessarily predicts the reward. There's still a prediction error over here. The current state gets improved at the next time step, and so you see this big activity in the dopamine neurons. Okay. Moreover, if you now remove the reward, so this is the third picture over here, the conditioning stimulus comes on, dopamine neurons start firing, they're expecting to see a reward. Okay, there's a positive prediction error at the moment, and then the reward does not appear. What you see is that the activity completely dies down. Okay, so this is consistent with having now a negative prediction error. Okay, negative error means dopamine gets suppressed. And if you look at the computational model over here, okay, which is just showing you where the TD errors are occurring, it is completely consistent with this physiological data. Okay, initially, we have prediction errors. When the reward comes, the reward is not expected. Later on, the error is associated with the stimulus because we're trying to learn that the stimulus is going to predict the reward. And then in the third panel, when the reward actually does not appear, then there's a negative prediction error, which is modeling the sort of dying down of the dopamine activity. So this was very exciting from the point of view of neuroscience because it's been replicated many times ever since, and it is a very consistent story. It's been replicated with monkeys, with rats, under different conditioning paradigms, not only instrumental conditioning, but also blocking effects, interaction effects. And there's this one very simple rule that seems to be modeling all of these phenomena very consistently. This is also interesting because what this says is that because dopamine is not really correlated with values, but actually with errors, we have to think of dopamine activity essentially as somehow predicting the amount of surprise that you're going to get from the environment. And this is very relevant if you're thinking of situations like, say, addiction to, be it food or drugs or anything else. Once an agent habituates to, say, a high level of sugar or a high level of fat, well, it's habituated, okay? And so in order to feel good, in order to get the little dopamine shot, it just needs more, okay? If the amount decreases, then your dopamine goes down, right? Then you feel bad about it. And so this is actually kind of interesting because it tells you that basically you can't expect drastic changes to lead to anything good, okay? Agents get habituated very quickly to high levels, but to bring the level down, you would have to do this very gradually. There's also the suggestion, perhaps, that regulating dopamine activity through other types of reward could be beneficial. And indeed, this is some of these papers that I tracked down that look at dopamine drugs regulating obesity, perhaps suggest such a link, that maybe, you know, if you tried either to set up a different reward system or to somehow in a different way regulate dopamine, that this would actually have a positive impact. So as I said, there's a lot of extensions to this story. There's a nice review article by Neve that appeared this year. There's a lot of current work going on with fMRI studies where instead of measuring neural responses directly, we look at fMRI data and try to model that using reinforcement learning. The story there seems to be also consistent with this type of learning mechanism. Now, the question is, how does the internal of the algorithm actually work? And so typically what we do is we estimate value functions separately and then compute these error measures. There's different ways to estimate value functions. I will mainly focus on feed-forward neural networks just because they have sort of interesting biological connections. So if you haven't seen this before, you probably know about neurons, okay, natural neurons. Typically, a neuron will have many different inputs coming in. The inputs are modulated by the strength of the synapses. There's an aggregation that happens inside the body of the neuron, and once the activation is above a certain threshold, the neuron begins firing, okay? So essentially, it sends out output to its neighbors, through its connections. So artificial neurons try to mimic this mathematically. We use weights, which are essentially a model of synaptic strength. You can think of high magnitude weights as sort of strengthening the connection between neurons, and we can, of course, have positive or negative influences here. There's this aggregation function here, which is typically a simple sum. This sort of tells you that we aggregate what's happening inside the neuron. And then there's an activation function or a transfer function. Usually this is some type of soft threshold function, which tells you when the neuron should start to fire. So the learning problem is given data to actually determine what these parameters or the connection weights should be. This is a simple example, very often used sigmoid neuron. The weights are typically learned from data by sort of trying to minimize the error at the output node. And this adjustment can be done as data comes in. And, of course, we can connect these neurons into deeper networks, okay, and essentially try to mimic the way that things function in the brain. The model here is what's called a feed-forward neural network. It's a little bit simplified compared to the brain, but it is a useful computational model in the sense that we understand its properties very well as its limitations. So here we have many different neurons which are connected, and each of these connections has a certain weight or strength. So each of these little nodes here essentially has this whole functionality inside. It takes its inputs, weighs them, sums them up, and then transmits an output modulated by the soft threshold function. And so the way this network computes is it gets its input, and then each of these neurons computes its output and sends it over, okay? And they're structured in layers. So you can think of the computation proceeding just forward layer by layer until we get the desired output. How do we train something like this? There's a well-known backpropagation algorithm known since the late 80s, very well studied. Essentially what we do is we do a forward pass computing the prediction of the network. We look at the error between the prediction and the data that was observed. And in our case, this is going to be the TD error. And then we use this error signal in order to change these parameters or these weights, okay, in order to essentially decrease the output error. So there's a forward pass, there's a backward pass, and in the backward pass, each of the neurons essentially gets assigned some of the blame of this prediction error, and you can think of this blame as being passed along the connection. So if two neurons are very strongly connected, they will get past the blame in very similar ways. If they're very weakly connected, the one that's sort of downstream will not be blamed as much. And again, this is an online process. It works as data comes in. We can even think of methods of adapting the structure of these networks if we don't know the structure ahead of time. This is a model called cascade correlation, which Tom Schultz here has had a lot of input on. So the idea here is that if we don't really know how big the network it should be, we will just add neurons in order to correct the remaining error. And so on the bottom picture here, you can see these nodes added one step at a time. Whenever we add a node, the other connections in the network are going to stay frozen, and the goal of this one node is correct whatever error is remaining. So it's a fairly fast process. It's a well-conditioned process. How do we do this with reinforcement learning? We just use these TD errors as the error signal. We use backpropagation to adjust the weights. If we want to add nodes, we can do cascade correlation. This is sort of one general blueprint. There's a lot of algorithmic variation. There's parameters and so on. But they are all based on these sort of core ideas. We want to estimate the prediction error. It's a temporal difference error. And then we want to adjust the weights to minimize that. So I hope I've convinced you that we have pretty good tools to understand the activity of dopamine and to understand conditioning. I have no idea if this can be useful to model obesity, but I, in some sense, I hope that I can find out more from you on this topic. Are there any questions?
Thank you very much.
Fantastic idea. So I have one question that if we think as an electric circuit, what it is, you are talking about the neuron, then if there is any leakage, say short circuit, then how you diagnose it? Maybe that is obesity. Or
that's an interesting question. So there's been a lot of work in low-level modeling of individual neurons, and there have been very detailed models, some of which include leakage. There's detailed models also of the ion channels that connect different neurons together. There is somewhat of a gap between the neuron level of modeling and how faithfully this reproduces the activity of whole neural networks in the brain. And one of the reasons why people are actually excited about this idea of using TD learning and dopamine is that if we look at the neuron level versus looking at the fMRI level, which is in some sense a macro level, we can explain both scales of phenomena. However, other phenomena are not well modeled when we put these individual neurons together and we look at the macro behavior of the system. And so in particular, exactly how the ion channels function and what role leakage plays is still, in some sense, an issue that's debated, that we don't have good answers for. But we do think that for certain sort of reasonably limited areas of learning and brain modeling, that we have reasonably good models that can explain the micro and the macro level.
can we go back to your model with expectation given the reward?
Yeah. This? Further?
Maybe.
This?
Yeah, there.
Yeah.
Oh, so you do control for the quadratic effect too?
So what happens here is we estimate this expectation. Okay,
yeah.
The expectation takes into account it's a linear quantity, right? It's looking at the linear combination of the rewards. Now you might want to ask about effects such as risk, maybe, or you know variance, or how does that impact anything? And this model does not take that into account. However, there is work on modeling the phenomena that happen in the amygdala, which look essentially at the variance of this quantity, okay, not the expectation, but the variance, and try to take that into account in the way that the agent explores. So if I have different actions and I think that the expectation is the same for all of them, how do I actually choose between them? And there you can use risk adversity versus risk-seeking behavior and try to get models for that. That part of the story is less worked out than this part.
Thank you for a very interesting talk. I was wondering, in modeling human learning, usually in reinforcement learning algorithms, we start with kind of defining the state space a priori, but for modeling how people learn, the question is how people are defining the state variables, and how do you deal with that problem? I'm just curious. So
that's a very good question. I think there's, in some sense, a disconnect between what people do when they try to set up successful reinforcement learning applications and what people do when they try to set up this in a cognitive context. For a successful application, you will try to engineer the state of the system in such a way as to capture whatever it is that you're trying to optimize, so to make the problem easier. There's a different line of work, mostly pursued by psychologists, which uses reinforcement learning where you don't actually know the state, and you try to construct the state from the sensory information that the agent has. And so in the learning process, there will be a phase where we estimate what the state might be, and then based on that, we estimate these value functions. If the value function estimates are off, then we will enrich the state, construct more information in the state, and proceed like that. This has connections to sort of other brain modeling parts, modeling basically the perceptual system, and because of that, again, the story is perhaps not as clear as here, but there's definitely work on sort of constructing good state representations.
Thank you very much for a very clear talk. Dopamine is also involved in incentive and motivation, and that's probably very relevant for obesity. And I wonder if you have any thoughts on how the dopamine signal, which is clearly a learning signal, can also be an incentive signal, a willingness to work for food, a willingness to a drive signal. How can the same signal be both of those things?
So that's an interesting question. Dopamine, in some sense, is unique in that it projects to many different areas of the brain, and it does seem to be involved in not only motivation, but, for example, some of the experiments that people have done is looking at dopamine and its connection to the rate at which animals take actions. So, for example, the rate at which the mouse presses its lever or the pigeon pecks at a certain point. And you can actually look at a sort of a version of this model, which is a continuous time model, which captures that type of behavior as well. And the idea in that model is basically that if you expect your average reward to be high, then you're going to work harder to get it. And so the action rate goes up, and otherwise it goes down. It's not clear exactly how to make the dopamine connection to obesity. It's certainly clear that dopamine is driven by these sort of reward prediction errors, and that once you habituate to a certain level of one kind of reward, then essentially dopamine activity, you know, stabilizes, and in some sense you don't feel as good about it anymore. And so one idea that has been passed around, not in this context, but in the context of drug addiction, is basically replacing the reward signal, which is detrimental, to a different reward signal, which you can sort of try to learn and predict, and which would you know, help you behave better. So for example, trying to replace the drugs that people use with something else that makes them feel good, such as playing video games or hanging out with friends or, you know, something else that, that essentially helps them feel better. That's a very complicated story, though, because we don't really understand what drives different people. And so, you know, reward for me might mean one thing than it might mean for you. And so at that point, we can't really draw a population conclusion. We kind of have to think of the individual and identify what might be meaningful to that individual and how to drive using that.
Thanks.
Let's take one more question, or two. If we'll take these two. Please, go ahead.
You're becoming loose.
Yeah.
Okay. This artificial neural network, people have used extensively for the purpose of classification. Mm-hmm. And they have also compared this one with other conventional methods of classification, which are classification and regression tree, logistic regression, and things like that. What this method does basically, you have input variables, and you have the end outcome. In between whatever happens, you don't know what is happening. So they call it as a black box approach, because you do not know what is happening. Now, if you take an example of what we are discussing, obesity. Now, for obesity is the outcome. Now, since morning, we have been discussing individual is one level, then this level, that level, and several levels. And then we are also discussing there is a pathways. We don't know what are the complex pathways. So in that situation, how would neural network work? Would it be able to help us in knowing that which pathways are crucial? Will it be able to assign weightage or importance or rank to different pathways so that one could take appropriate action?
So that's a bit of a different use of a neural net compared to the one that I talked about here. Supervised learning, classification being one example of that, is a different paradigm. So, for example, if you think of the backgammon case, doing supervised learning there would mean that I have data from an expert which says, in this particular position, here's the correct move, and the other moves are not correct. So instead, the model that I talked about now is temporally based and essentially tries to make predictions more accurate at the current step based on a little bit of data that I see going forward. Now, that being said, it's definitely true that neural nets can help as classification tools for the kind of data that people talked about here this morning. So, for example, we could try to predict obesity outcomes based on data about the individual, data about the community, and so forth. And, you know, I actually look forward to looking at some of these data sets to see how we can actually use them. A neural net is not an explanatory model in the sense that it's very hard to figure out, even if I have good prediction error, what it is that's driving that good prediction error. If you want to have explanations, it's much better to use technology like rule-based systems or decision trees, which actually have a form that's easily inspectable. Neural net, in some sense, is like a little brain. You know, there's connection strengths, but I can't really tell you necessarily what they mean, okay, or how they influence the outcome. They can certainly give some idea of whether we can build good predictions. That's a different story. There's other technologies, too. For example, in the classification world nowadays, there's been a lot of work on support vector machines. It's a little bit of a different kind of classification approach, but where you can identify, in some sense, important cases in the data, and then classification happens with respect to those. So there again, from the point of view of obesity data, it could be interesting because perhaps it can identify, say, problematic communities or problematic situations and drive from there.
Take one more.
Very quick. Can the dopamine response explain the placebo effect?
Yes. yes, it can, because dopamine is it's internal to you, okay? And so in some sense, the dopamine effect is with respect to any kind of reward signal that might be driving you. Now, in these particular experiments that I showed you, we have one unique reward signal, which is food, and everything else is isolated. However, in something like the placebo effect, if I believe that I'm taking a pill, right, then that can generate in itself a reward signal. And it may work differently from person to person, but essentially once I have a reward signal of some sort, could be internal or external, then we can use dopamine to explain these prediction errors.
Thank you very much, Doreen.